right. So we're here again after our break. I'm Anil Tripathi.
I'm Ryan Collins.
And I'm Adam Gamwell.
And today we're going to be talking about altered states. So the last two episodes, we started off with sleep, which is definitely a very different state from being awake. Mm-hmm. Then we went on to dreams, which is even, you know, another state within sleep or even during the day if you're daydreaming.
Right.
And now we're going into altered states, which can include anything from, you know, trance, from sleep deprivation, starvation, any other form of deprivation, or drug use, intoxicants. Just so many different forms of altered states. So even, a psychological state. So this is, you know, another topic that I think brings actually a lot of the similar issues that we discussed with regards to sleep and dreams and a lot of the ideas of morality involved, right?
Mm-hmm.
And different social issues that map back to a very, you know, the early beginnings in our civilization.
Right. And I think it's really important to consider that since the dawn of, you know, human society, we've been involved with different types of substances, different types of intoxicants, if you will, that have created these altered states of being. But we placed value on those states of being, and not just in that they make us, you know, happy or that they make us friendly. Sometimes they make you aggressive. So what is it that makes people come together to sort of propagate these states of being? And in some sense, that's a closeness to some sort of deity. We see cross-culturally that religion plays a huge part of this. But there's more to it than that, and I think that we should return to the beerscape to think about this.
Mm.
Now, our lovely theme of the beerscape, which has come up time and time again this season, really gets to the crux of this creation of beer. And as we talked about before, beer is something that may have, in fact, helped society form, may have helped early societies come together, because it provided not only a fuel, the energy resource to do so, but it provided a means of payment for people to actually come together in this congregation to celebrate their own creations.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think about that, we take it to the next level, these altered states are fostering the creative process. They're fostering something new and innovative, which is integral to what we think of in the human condition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we as people, we do have this drive, it seems, you know, at least modern Homo sapiens, you know, that we know of, or certainly by the time the beerscape came around, you know, we're talking maybe 9,000 years. So really within the past 9,000 years and sooner that we know of have been imbibing these certain types of objects, certain types of consumables, in this case beer, that have sort of shaped or alter the ways that we think about the world, right? And so what this does is, as you said, Ryan, like, is there a certain value placed on this, right? And part of it alters our behavior, part of it alters our mental perception. So we have this juxtaposition between our actions and our thoughts. And so the cool thing to think about with the beerscape is how it shapes both of these two kinds of things, right?
Exactly.
As anthropologists, we're interested in both of these, like what people do, but also their experience, what they think, you know, what life is about. And so the beerscape, again, sort of ties together. And the beerscape, again, is just this funny way of us saying landscape that has to do with beer, right? this milieu, this world that people live in, that beer is sort of infused throughout of it. I guess Sam Adams would want the same thing, right?
Right.
But beer is an interesting thing to think about, right? Because you're right, it does so many things. It can be a form of payment. It can be an actual thing you consume. It is something that induces an altered state. It can be used to sort of show prestige or wealth for different people if you have different kinds of beer. Here, you know, in Somerville, Massachusetts, in Boston, in Brighton, in Cambridge, in Woburn, Wellesley, all these different places, right, that beer is consumed differently in these little places too, right? And there's certain kinds of beer people want to have, and there's different identities tied with it. So with this sort of altering substances, like beer in this case, it attaches all of these kinds of things of human being, right? And the question is sort of human condition, right? It touches on all of these in many different ways.
Yeah, exactly. And it creates so many things in our society in ways it almost, you know, creates our cities or even our civilizations. Thinking about even the beginning of the United States and how important tobacco was,
mm-hmm.
right? And we also think about Sydney mints and sweetness and power,
yeah.
and the power of sugar high, the sugar scapes, you know, tobacco scapes, all of these different substances, even coffee.
Right,
and we've talked about on the show before how these substances become almost integral parts of people's identities.
Right,
going back to Italy and the idea of, you know, having espresso in Rome, Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the different types of coffee, the different preparations people will make, very similar almost to food. But then also having this almost, I feel, another level of connection due to almost the altered state, similar to, you know, smokers going out and having a cigarette together.
Exactly. And what you bring up with that, with smoking and going outside to have a cigarette, there is a time and a place for each of these different types of altered states. And cross-culturally, you know, if our altered states are fostering these creative processes, they're fostering different types of ideas, but they can also be detrimental as well. Mm-hmm. So we have to caution that. And as a society, we do, by placing the time and place and restricting when or where and if certain substances are to be used and how they are to be used.
Yeah, and that's one of the most interesting things to think with this, because, you know, why we place taboos on something, or Mary Douglas, right, the anthropologist, talks about taboos and this sort of purity and danger, things you can and cannot touch and when and you should or should not, you know, imbibe them or touch them. When it comes to altered or mind-altering substances like beer or caffeine even, right, of course, that's what you're saying, Anil, that's an important one to think about, too. Caffeine does alter the way that we operate, as we all have a nice obsession with coffee here in this room. But a nice healthy obsession, right? We won't say addiction. But
socially accepted.
Yes, a socially accepted obsession with coffee. And you're right that it's like it does point to this interesting thing about, you know, societal norms of when it is okay to use these things. And, of course, with us, you know, what we'll talk about today and think through is that there are times when the same substance is thought of differently, when it's different times it's okay to use it. Again, to come back to the beerscape real quick, I mean, for the vast majority of human history of imbibing beer, right, again, the idea that we now have you need to be 21 in the United States to drink beer, 18 in other countries, you know, the common parlance is the idea with that is the human brain is developing up until 21. I don't know if it stops after that, but it's developing a certain way, right, up until 21.
And I would even caution that up to 25 these days, people are saying...
Don't tell the government.
Right.
But right, yeah, exactly. So that's the thing. The question is, why was it 21? And you're right, now new neurological research says maybe 25. But again, other countries that have 18, you know, what's the difference? So again, there's an interesting mix between what we may say is biology or neurology, you know, this age of when the brain would not be developing in a way that could be damaged so much by beer or other altering substances, versus national laws, right, or other kinds of taboos that you can or can't, when it's okay or not, right, to drink beer. Of course, now we've all heard the story of our friends in high school, right, that would sneak into dad's liquor cabinet and, you know, get that old bottle of Jim Beam or something, right? And again, that's not socially acceptable, but it also is socially acceptable, right? It may be nationally taboo. It's against the law, but it may be culturally acceptable. We're not condoning underage drinking here.
I mean, National Lampoon and the whole...
And the Animal House.
Even, you know, in high school, the movies like Dazed and Confused, right? Mm-hmm. There are social role models for this kind of behavior.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, right? Because in our society, we both have... we have, you know, so many different models that people can choose from. And with beer especially, I think we see the power of the social in dictating what is right and what is wrong. Especially when you have the idea of the social drinker, right, versus the guy who's drinking alone in a chair in some dark alleyway somewhere or in his
yeah,
house.
Right.
You know, there's the idea that if you're drinking together, it's much better, right? And a lot of that comes in with the fact that it's, you know, with people, it's collective.
Hmm. Right.
You're actually being social, whereas in another case, there's the idea of addiction and that you're being antisocial and away from society.
And still, we have the other image of the drunk in the alleyway, as you say, versus the guy or girl or whatever reindeer at the end of the day that's having the beer to unwind. You know, we find these different acceptable notions of when and where. And I think this gets to a really important thing about society, being that we have the main, you know, dominant social power forces out there that have these explicit rules. Then we also have, you know, those counter norms, like the counter hegemonic forces of sorts, of going into your parents' alcohol cabinet when you're in high school and stealing some kind of bottle of liquor, because this is socially acceptable. Mm-hmm. You're expected to do this as a teenager.
Yeah, you might even have some peer pressure to do it, right?
Exactly.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's interesting, I think, where you have these tensions and what's acceptable and what's not. You know, Anthony Giddens in Runaway World, he talks about how addiction is almost the side effect of a highly individualized society, right? In that addiction, any kind of repetitive act done by an individual alone is destructive, right? But then if you do repetitive acts in a group, it's productive almost. There are these various tensions. And it's interesting also when we look at substances, I think, in that there's almost this divide, right? There's almost these two different positivities. It's similar when you think about the marijuana debate, right, and legalization, and how marijuana didn't go from being bad to being just ambivalent. It has to go from being bad to actually being positive, right, and being medical marijuana first. So it's this interesting flip, I think. And we see this a lot of times with different substances, right? Cocaine was actually a pharmaceutical, and Merck Pharmaceuticals produced the largest quantity of cocaine in the world in the past. So we have these very fine lines, almost these liminal zones for substances.
Right, and for medicinal purposes too, as you said. And that's, I think it's a great point to think in the general idea of what we call drugs now, right? Whether it is pharmaceuticals that we may take, which you can take something called Marinol, which is synthetic THC, which is the component in marijuana that would get you high.
Yes.
Or again, you could smoke the plant or you could eat that. So, I mean, like there's different ways to get it, but the idea is Marinol is a perfectly legal, acceptable and medical substance you can take. Now, of course, you're seeing now we see the plant itself, marijuana, and the name is different, of course, right? Marinol versus marijuana. But the idea is the plant is now sort of coming in this new light of medicinal use, right? And some 17 states now have medical marijuana licenses, and, you know, we're going to more. And science point to the two more states, I think Oregon and Maine will be looking at legalization of marijuana, too, for just recreation use. But again, you're right. The idea is that it can go back and forth, too. You know, and again, the story of marijuana is really particularly interesting because if our listeners know this, it's if you look kind of back at the history of prohibition, you know, again, of course, the idea of when alcohol was put, you know, made illegal. At a similar time in the 30s, that's when marijuana was also made illegal because it was, you know, it grown primarily in Mesoamerica, Central America, and then it was kind of brought up with Latin American workers to the U.S. South. And, you know, there's a lot of racism in sort of imported labor, what we're going to call it, or migrant labor. Usually on the part of people that are hiring them. And I'm not going to call that in general blanket sense, but we see it again in the case of marijuana. And the long story short here is that ultimately marijuana was sort of enjoyed by the workers after a long day of work, you know, in the same way that Egyptians would have beer. They get paid in beer. You get to hang out and have your beer, you know. But what we would see is the case is that some of the ranch owners and lawmakers didn't like this, and they thought of a way of sort of punishing the workers from being, in essence, different, which is a weird way of saying it. But and so they worked with William Randolph Hearst, actually, who was the big paper baron. And the idea is he had some pals in Congress. And so as you know, William Randolph Hearst was kind of a big industry tycoon in the 30s and 40s.
Right, he was a newspaper.
Newspaper, yeah. And so one of the things is that, of course, the other half of a newspaper is paper. There's the news part and there's the paper part. And so he wanted to use sort of pulp from trees. Now, if you look at the fiber content, we won't get into the biology of this, but hemp, not marijuana, but hemp, the cousin of marijuana, is actually a much stronger fibrous plant than our trees to make paper out of. And the paper lasts longer. And actually some of the reason we have things like papyrus and other plants and paper surviving over thousands of years or hundreds of years is because they're made from not trees. They're made from papyrus reeds. They're made from hemp. The Portuguese made ropes and sails out of hemp on their ships. So it's a very strong, I mean, so you can make rope and paper out of the same thing, which is interesting. Now, but what they did with this is that then they ended up making marijuana and hemp, which is related to it, illegal. Not because the plant is seen as a demonized thing at this time, but because, again, that provided one of the biggest competitions to the pulp paper industry for William Randolph Hearst, since he had some friends in Congress. Now, this may sound like a conspiracy theory, and you know, I'm kind of rambling on about this, but it's documented. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
But it raises questions about the notion of taboo with substances, right? Why do we see certain things becoming illegal or not, right? And again, what does it say about society as we're kind of pointing to
it
as
does.
Well? I don't know, but it raises some interesting questions about why we're seeing, and as you said, now we're seeing marijuana sort of return to a notion of goodness, or in this case, as medicine, right?
Well, it's interesting to consider this perspective you just brought up, because I'd never actually heard that. And this sort of tabooing, this process of, you know, making marijuana taboo is really kind of different than the other processes of different types of drugs becoming tattoo. Apparently I've had too much coffee. But in this process of making it taboo, people we're looking at it not for the reasons you might think, that the typical reasons might be addiction, or it might be illness, or like pandemics. Right. Like when we think of historically with the opium wars and the British bringing opium to China in order to get, in a really terrible way, the trade goods that they wanted from people.
Which was also very almost similar to the Hearst story, right? And being so economically motivated.
Exactly. Yes, it's an economic motivation.
Important point.
But this is like that dark side of it, instead of using this to get what you want by denying people something that is, for all intents and purposes, fine. You're forcing something that is not good on a society that is causing social breakdowns.
Mm-hmm. And again, just a point, as you said, this, like, the political and economic realities of that, right?
Yes.
And it's why when it comes to these questions of taboo, it's such a fascinating, you know, topic to dive into, right? Because, again, we're not here to be controversial, you know, and we're not trying to say, you know, legalize everything or not. But again, because, I mean, laws are in place for a reason, right? But it does raise important questions of, like, can we think about the bigger picture here, right?
Exactly.
Why do we see this happening? And again, you're right, the opium trade is an interesting comparative to this idea of marijuana illegalization and now potential legalization.
Because at first glance, we would recognize taboo in that, well, they're both drugs and they both cause X, Y, and Z.
Right.
But if we take a deeper approach to this, something that's more versatile, we recognize the one is taboo because it's causing social fission. It's causing deep things that are causing society to go wrong. The other is taboo.
For some people.
For some people.
Yeah.
Well, that was the intent that the British had. Anyway.
Of course, yes.
Ancient Brits, not the guys today. We like them.
They're all right.
But it's different for this other taboo that was coming in with marijuana, because that's taking away from society what was already going okay for other economic reasons.
Right.
It's also fascinating to think about how even the same substance, right, can come in so many different forms and so many different ideas are transferred onto those forms as well, right? If you think about coca leaves versus cocaine.
Absolutely.
Evo Morales' campaign in Bolivia, which was heavily connected to indigenous rights and, you know, the coca leaf industry.
Yeah, and autonomy too, right?
Exactly. Yes. So you have all these ideas that connect. So it's similar, you know, with the William Randolph Hearst story, right? You have this guy who had this economic interest, but he was also, I doubt he would have been able to do that if there hadn't been this larger social idea, almost this racism towards immigrants coming from the South, right?
Yeah.
So there, these things map on to each other.
Absolutely.
You know, there are always so many different factors coming to play in the way that any substance is viewed and used.
Right.
But, you know, it's similar even thinking about ayahuasca, right? So ayahuasca in a lot of South American cultures, in Brazil especially, and Peru, you have this idea, right, of, you know, you go on this almost two-day trip, or is this, you know, very elongated process where you're really trying to look for something, you know, beyond. You're trying to kind of get some sort of enlightenment. But now in the U.S., we have this street drug DMT, which, you know, dimethyltryptamine, which is an incredibly consolidated, almost like cocaine form of ayahuasca, it seems to degree. And in the U.S., this is called the businessman's drug, because if you smoke it, you go up in 10 minutes and then it's over. You have this intense trip and then you can go back to your job or whatever you do in society. So, you know, it's this, the same substance, right, but an incredibly different role in the community, or how even the people utilizing it are using it.
Right. It's an interesting, I mean, there's tons of stuff there. I mean, in terms of just the idea of, like, this is a timed drug, you know, you can think about. But there's these great bigger questions in terms of, like, what's the impetus behind even changing the form of this, you know? And then also, as you said, Ryan, about calling something a drug at all, right? When we talk about opium in the same category as marijuana as drugs, right?
Right.
The initial language, particularly from health policy, is addiction, health detriment, et cetera, right? And it totally eschews what we may care also about in this conversation, at least, right, is the political economic factors that go into, like, you know, what makes this drug legal or not, but again, also who, where did it come from, who may want to use it, but the bigger questions of, like, why we as people even care about altered states.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, even just to take this a step further, right, caffeine is a drug.
Sure.
So coffee is a drug.
Tylenol
is a drug.
You know,
is a drug.
Yeah.
All these things.
Advil,
hell, even sugar is, in some ways, an altering
It could be, substance. Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's Sidney Mintz, as you said, in Sweetness and Power. It certainly points to, like, the changing of the making of the English working class because they had the sugar and actually the caffeine from tea from India right, mixed together that made working longer hours possible on a cheap caloric boost, you know? Yeah, we could absolutely, I think, call that into the drug category, right? And we could say certainly we're a sugar-addicted people in the United States right now. You know, and salt and fat and whatever else.
Yeah, and also corn syrup, right, which is now our cheap sugar that ends up in all our food. It's also, you know, with also thinking about the same substances being used in different ways, we can even look at how we've been dealing with opiate addictions in the United States especially. And, you know, even Massachusetts politician Marty Meehan is actually recently, I think just yesterday on a retreat, trying to really tackle the opiate almost crisis we're having in Massachusetts, which is almost largely created by the pharmaceutical industry and our legal drugs, right? Because people get Oxycontin or they get access to these very heavy opioid painkillers after they break a leg or they have some sort of an injury. So they get it legally initially.
Right.
But then, you know, for whatever reason, if the dosage is too high that they were prescribed or whatnot, they'll kind of long for that high again, right? And then they might be more likely to try to find this drug illegally, whether by buying the prescription illegally or, you know, going towards cheaper illegal derivatives like heroin and other forms.
And, I mean, with the pharmaceutical issue of these opiates being out there, you're seeing so many different factors coming into being because if you get injured, that's a cause to get painkillers. It's a cause to get certain types of opiates. And not every opiate works on everybody. So there are ways to play that system to get what you want, to get what you think you might need by falsifying injuries or other things. So people are able to get into these circuits of not being able to work and then pulling more opiates into their system in order to prolong this sort of cycle. And then with that, you know, you have things like methadone, which were initially intended to get people off of heroin, which it, in and of itself, it is an opiate, but then it's also used as a painkiller. So then methadone is sometimes used to treat those same types of addictions, which will in turn foster those same addictions. And with this, and this is just an interesting subject to think about, we have this rise of the rehab culture. That you're going to these rehab clinics. It's a safe location to go to these places where they will give you those same type of cocktails to get off of the other pharmaceutical cocktails.
It's almost a continuous industry. I think there was actually an anthropological piece, Patients Are Consumers! Point, which is actually a wonderful piece describing how our pharmaceutical industry has almost changed from the idea of, you know, curing people, right, to treating. So you're not, there's not a one-time cure. You know, you people are continually being treated.
Yes.
And you have to be continually on your medications. So it's the kind of the rise of the chronic illness and how we have to treat all these things. But, and of course, there are some really serious chronic illnesses, such as diabetes, hypertension, a lot of issues. But then you also have bipolar disorder.
Yes.
Longer, you know, mental illnesses, even addictions could be seen as a continued issue, because especially in our systems, in our security systems and whatnot, once you get labeled as a drug addict, that automatically starts putting you in different categories and you're treated with different substances.
Right. Yeah.
And another thing I want to bring up about these potential situations where you're going into a rehab clinic, you know, a lot of the people who are going to these places because of prescription pills and other things like that are not the stereotypical drug users that come to mind when we conjure images of, you know, what it is to be a druggie or a junkie or however we're going to term it. But people get into networks, so they find out who's giving them what, and then you can trade this all around to pass around the information in order to facilitate that cycle.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, kind of a connecting theme of what y'all are saying that I see is this, as we said, actually, you were with Anthony Giddens, Anil, before, and that, like, this connection between the individual and the group here in society, right? And even the idea of why we even sort of engage in altered state-ing or putting ourselves in altered states, and how it's this mix between, you know, we tend to then, particularly in the medical system that we use in pharmaceuticals now, like, these treat individuals, right? Granted, you can't like treat a group in the same way as you treat an individual with an injection or something. But again, you could inject a population, which we've seen happen usually for bad reasons, like the Tuskegee experiments, which involved actually, well, we'll get into that later. It's a very bad thing, but look up the Tuskegee experiment. It's a racist science, basically, that involved injecting African-Americans with syphilis. But the point is, again, done as, quote, medical science. But again, so even when individuals versus groups are sort of are administered certain kind of medicines or drugs or whatever, or whether it's Oxycontin or we're talking about altered states in this case, like, there are issues of class and power and race involved in these, right? Absolutely. And that we have to be attentive to. It can be an uncomfortable topic, of course, but it's absolutely plays into, again, you know, as you said, Ryan, you know, we don't have to say anything, but, like, we think about what is a junkie and whatever comes to whoever's mind.
Right.
That is an indicative reflection of some ways of your notions of race, power, class, whatever they are.
Exactly.
All of us, right? And it's important to think about that, too, you know, because, again, these issues may or may not have mattered the same way, certainly not thousands of years ago. I mean, they do now in certain ways because we have certain kinds of identities. We've been talking about the nation or Benedict Anderson's imagined communities. We've talked about a few times in the show, and that we're connected as citizens of the nation,
exactly,
which we have no other relation besides the fact that we all live in the United States, right? But nonetheless, we can talk about the American sentiment or the American morality about we should not drink before we're 21.
Yes.
We should not you know, drive before we're 16 or whatever, you know, or shouldn't take substances because we're a good moral nation or something. And I think, well, at the minimum, it puts a lot of pressure on the individual because we have this sort of group mentality, this group idea of what this could be. But, what is, you know, how do we live that? And when it comes to this sort of altered states or prescription drugs, particularly, again, with applications to people, it's very tricky. And we see the rise of the rehab clinics, you're saying, too, and, like, how these pieces fit together. It's like, you know, there's kind of tectonic plates. They're big pieces, you know. But they absolutely play into this, you know.
You know, you make me really think of two things I want to bring up here. And one of them comes from the Tuskegee experiments and thinking about the state and what types of drugs or even altering of the body constitutes something that might be validated as good or understood as something that could be good, but in and of itself is a hegemonic constraint. But before we get to that, I wanted to bring up how recent issues in pop culture have caused a lot of people to start questioning what it is to be a drug addict these days. With the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, with the death of a number of other high-label actors in Hollywood who are dying of overdoses with heroin or complications because of other drug substances, it's causing people to really reconsider what it is or who it is that's using these drugs, and that it could be anybody as opposed to being what we might stereotype.
Yeah, that's a great point to think about. It's a great thing to think about. It's like, it's never just necessarily one group. We may think it is, but then you're right.
Exactly.
Then someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman, which I was shocked at, you know, I mean, I didn't know the guy, but I mean, if I did, maybe I would not have been shocked, but you're right. If you think about how could an A-list actor die of a heroin overdose, right? But again, the idea is it can be anybody.
Exactly.
As you're saying, yeah, it's like we shouldn't presuppose one way or the other, right? Which is hard, of course, because we are taught to stereotype all the time, you know, for better, for worse, probably for worse. You know, I mean, we as humans, we classify things, right? That's
right.
Part of being a human being.
It's part of our brain's quest for meaning, right? We automatically project ideas that we have onto our surroundings, which includes people.
Yeah, absolutely. But then the question is, of course, we have to know where do these ideas come from, right? We don't just imagine people are bad.
I mean, in some ways, we think about evolutionary terms of classifying things. We think about a substance that if you eat randomly, that could kill you. You classify as, I don't want to eat that mushroom. That mushroom's kind of okay.
Yeah.
That flower is good. That flower isn't. And these type of, you know, I'm losing my words right here. These classifications.
Mm-hmm.
Again, too much coffee. These classifications are things that we use for survival instincts on some level.
Right.
And they carry over in our social judgments.
Yeah. And again, that's just our hope as anthropologists. I think you're absolutely right. And like to be aware of that.
Exactly.
And to understand, too, that in, you know, on a certain level, we get past survivability to, we're making stuff up now, which is fine. Like, it doesn't make it not true. One of the things that we can always get like kind of weird about with anthropology, or people can ask questions and say, well, if you think everything is socially constructed, that means it's not real. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely not true at all, right? That means
exactly.
It's absolutely more real.
Right.
Because we buy into it. We believe it. This is part of this is part of our existence.
Like one of the things we always talk about in Human Origins is that, yes, race is not a biological category. It has no biological validity. But when we talk about it as a social issue, there, race is a social phenomenon. It's socially real.
Yeah.
And that's something that we have to recognize, that these are social constructs, that we have to try to work past them, that mm-hmm. there is no biological grounding to these, but mm-hmm. yet we still make social issues out of them.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, the big challenge with that is that then we become responsible for this, right?
Right.
And which I think is also, it's a powerful thing. It's something that gives me hope and you know, a sense of strength, is that, like, it is challenging to recognize something like race as a, we could do an episode on this actually, but to talk about something, you know, as race as a social construct versus a biological one, which is anthropology. Yeah, that's one of the big tenets that we've been working to stick out since Franz Boas, one of our founding fathers of American anthropology, has been talking about, you know, that race is a social thing, not biological. But the point here is that, like, then we become responsible for that knowledge. And, you know, hopefully here with this anthropological life, we can drop some knowledge every once in a while, but
help out with our social constructs.
Our social constructs,
because that's
yeah,
the
yeah.
thing, right? Whatever we create to replace the constructs that we have, those will also be future constructs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? And that really drives home the fact that, you know, it's not that these are any less meaningful when you try to deconstruct it. That's actually when you see the intense meaning of mm-hmm. these systems and where it comes from.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And that's power. I mean, every time that you get rid of one regime of power, another thing has to come and take its place, right? Mm. You can't just disavow it and live in a complete anarchical society. That'd be magnificent. Maybe.
Possibly.
David Graeber would think so.
Right. Yeah. Maybe John Lennon's Imagine. I'm thinking those type of images, right? Painting myself as a Marxist here. But... But, you know, we always have to replace something with what's going to come in line next. If we're able to proceed past different biases, another set of biases that we're not even aware of are going to come in.
Right.
And that's going to be that next struggle, that next thing that people are going to have to take down and challenge.
Yeah. And that's where the challenge for us comes in, right?
Is that
we recognize we're responsible for producing paradigms of thought. And I mean, that's a powerful point, though, too. It's like we're able to do this because we recognize what it is, and we're not going to change the world here, but together we can. Uh-huh. You know, and it sounds like John Lennon there, doesn't it? You know,
imagine. Or at least the world will be different.
Or it'll be different, right, anyway. You know, yeah. Things change anyway.
I mean, this actually seems to relate very well to the great Chomsky and Foucault debate that's up on YouTube that everyone should definitely go check out, right? Because that's really what Chomsky's saying is, right, that we should be trying to, you know, create this better society, right? But then Foucault keeps on... Yeah. Talking about, you know, how, oh, but our, you know, our constructs will appear anyway, and there'll be this discipline, and there'll be our violence, and there'll be the power dynamics. They'll just continue.
Yeah, and that's, Foucault is famous for talking about discursive power, right? That it's this discourse that we, as individuals, essentially are powerless to change. And Chomsky was saying, no, we can do something about it. And again, whether you fall on either side of that debate, of course, you know, please
of them are valid.
They're both, and that's a great point, too, right, that makes this so challenging. There's two valid sides, at least, to this.
And I do see that there's a resolution that can be made of the two, because, I mean, Foucault himself did also talk about the progress of society, how society was bettering itself, and he wasn't necessarily too keen on picking out, you know, individuals as being the key mover here, but he did recognize that things were changing in his different historical discourses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, seeing how power is sort of exerted through sexuality, through ideas of pleasure, like through ways that the body was exerted.
Oh, yeah. And I think the interesting thing with Foucault, right, is in that conversation, he sounds kind of almost pessimistic.
Right.
But I actually, sometimes when I read Foucault, I really see him as almost an extreme optimist in the idea of human potential. And once you realize the social structures around you, once you realize the power dynamics and everything, the constraints on you, you also see the possibilities. Mm-hmm. Within those constraints.
Yeah.
And the idea of trying to express your identity to the fullest that it can be where you are.
Yeah.
You know, try to open as many doors as possible within this house of power, almost. And of course, you know, relating back to our idea of substances and altered states, Foucault did write heavily, you know, his History of Madness, when he talks about the rise of mental institutions.
Yes.
Of different, you know, categorizations and then treatment, right? Mm-hmm. Which was, as we've been talking about earlier, does heavily involve lots of psychiatry and substances within our society.
Yeah, and I think that it's a great segue back forward and around to altered states, because the idea of, right, in terms of medicalization is what we might call that, right? And the notion of, like, there's a certain proper biological and mental way to be. And we can treat people to get to this, whatever the state is, that is the proper way of being. But then altered states, of course, operate around that.
Right. Yeah, this is interesting because we might want to retitle this episode Altered States and Altered Nation States. But we do have these sanctionings of what is constituted as an okay or an endorsed altered state. Excuse me, getting over a cold, too.
Which are also altered states, right? Illnesses. Yeah.
Well, America runs on Duncan.
Yeah.
Sam Adams, you know, we have a...
Runs on Duncan.
Well, we have a founding father of sorts pictured on a beer bottle, and this is another way of getting to that endorsement, right?
Yeah. And from a beer that was just founded in the 80s and 70s, right?
Exactly. And Budweiser and other ones often have, like, symbols of America. You know, they have American flags or Coors as the Rocky Mountains. And different substances like that are taking advantage of the symbols associated to them.
Right.
Because we are sanctioned by the state, and we follow the state's rules. In fact, we have them listed on our cans.
Right. I mean, we're part of them. And this is, again, this nation state or the imagined community that Benedict Anderson talks about,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
Like, the Rockies have nothing to do with America, besides the fact that they're in the United States.
Yes.
Right? Mm. Oh, congratulations, Rockies. They're not even called the Rockies to the Rockies, right? That's what the U.S. calls them. Mm. But you're right. Then Coors can tap into the Rockies, right? Literally, and then make this part of their symbolism, which makes them a national brand, right? Mm. Not just Colorado's famous beer, but just the Rockies span the U.S. from north to south, you know? Right. No, span the Americas.
Advertising's incredibly fascinating when you think about substances, right? Like even cigarette advertisements, the famous camel leg, which is actually a woman's leg, right?
Uh-huh.
It's subliminal advertising that really tries to play off of people's, you know, innate desires or their ideas, right? Yeah. So you can use nationalism to sell substances. You can use sex to sell substances. You can use all these different ideas, which are some, you know, completely, totally unrelated.
Right.
To the substances. I remember I saw an ad for Domino's Pizza yesterday that was saying, you know, pizza isn't going to make your weekend. It's what you do with the pizza that'll make your weekend. So that's the thing, right? So they're trying to, you know, put their substance, which is cheesy pizza, into our, you know, social arrangements and our lives.
Yeah, so I think it's really cool to think about for the idea of altered states and altered nation states because, again, we began talking about narcotics potentially and opiates in this way, but then we've moved to, we can say, not as directly opiate products, or you can call pizza opiate if you want to, but right, but things that aren't classified as narcotics now anyway. But the idea of how the mixing of the Rockies or Domino's and like what you do with this product will make you have a good weekend, or the way advertising works, in some ways acts as a state altering mechanism as well for our mental state. And perhaps our behavioral state, too, right? If you get this pizza, then you will act X and you're going to have a great weekend.
Exactly.
You know, we tie these things together in this very interesting way from substances that we don't consider to be narcotic or altering. But again, how do they alter the way we think?
No, it shapes our desires, right? Which is kind of a mind alteration. I mean, technically, our minds are being altered constantly, right?
Right.
Because our brains are constantly changing depending on what you're listening to. All of you guys out there listening to us are being mind altered by our words and whatnot. It's, you know, everything that you do in your life affects you.
Yeah.
But we do in our society have this strong notion of almost the ability to control yourself, control your emotions, right? And it relates a lot back to the individual.
Right.
And the idea that you need to be responsible for your actions, responsible, right, in a way that ties to society.
Exactly. But it's not just tying it to society. These are tied to bodily experiences, to the way in which we think, or we're almost exposed to think that this is the way that life should be. This is what is available to you. And so, again, thinking about state alterations that force you to alter your own states altering states, you have flu shots, right? We're always going in every flu season to our local pharmacy getting the flu shots. In different vaccinations, you know, we think that the human experience should be conditioned by being disease-free. Do we get side effects from these? Sometimes. But those are risks that we're willing to take in order to preserve this type of life, right? This state-sanctioned idea of what life is supposed to be.
Yeah, that's a great thing. This notion of there's a certain element of control here, right? In that,
right.
In these kind of altered states can help us with that. Now, Neely, you and I last time for the episode on dreams, we're talking about why dreams are so an interesting part of this theme we've been covering here in season two, because dreams are particularly uncontrollable, right? We talked a little about lucid dreaming, but overall, dreams are these things we don't control, and we do them in a state that we can call altered, right? Or consciousness is sleeping, right? And there's something about, obviously, you know, dreams don't threaten us enough that we don't go to sleep. We did talk about the nightmare versus the dream and like why you may still wake up, you know, because you're terrified. But then I think, and we can talk more about this for Altered States Part 2 or Altered Nation States Part 2 next week. But the idea about there's certain substances that people may choose to take, like psychotropics or psilocybin or mushrooms or something, or LSD, like Timothy Leary in the experiments he did. Is he at Harvard?
Yeah.
And the idea with these, or DMT, if you're saying, which is subtitled the spirit molecule to some.
Exactly. Yes. So many ideas are being mapped onto these substances.
Right. And then the notion of uncontrollability comes with that, though, in the same way that we may think about dreams is kind of what I was thinking of. Not that these substances I would liken them to dreams necessarily, but there's this uncontrollability or this altered stateness that we're drawn to in the same way that we're drawn to dreaming.
Yes. That
I think we may find dreaming attractive, besides what it may be doing, but also because we may like it as something that it is neat. Cause it's this unmapped space in which anything is possible. Literally anything is possible.
That's true.
But then it's also, even that is confined within sleep. Right.
Right.
So we do have some sort of structure within this openness.
Yeah. And in some ways I wonder if kind of the dialogue around these certain kinds of psychotropic drugs, the danger is there because it is like dreaming, but you don't have that mental confine because you may actually physically be moving. Walking down the street or something.
Right? Yeah.
It's very interesting to think about with the colloquial names that we give to some of these substances. So if we think of absinthe, you know, type of alcohol, the green fairy, or the old colloquialism for opium was chasing the dragon.
Yeah.
And again, for crystal meth, it was angel dust.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, these ways of enacting that fantasy in a contained, well, maybe not contained, but
hopefully
in some sort
contained,
of
yeah.
environment that causes you to reenact or feel that dream, to live out that fantasy.
It's really fascinating also to think about, you know, the different ways that users will use it, as we've been talking about earlier with ayahuasca or these different substances, and even thinking about Timothy Leary.
Yeah.
You know, Timothy Leary basically built almost kind of a mansion compound. I forget exactly where it was, but it's actually described very well in Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe.
Hmm.
Which is this really wonderful biography of Ken Casey, who of course wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and whatnot, and was one of the very adamant supporters of LSD in the 60s. So he had this group, the Merry Pranksters, right? And they went around actually spiking people's drinks without their knowledge with LSD. So you have this kind of open, you know, let's go crazy, let's drive around America and give everyone acid. And then you have Timothy Leary, who built this kind of mansion and tried to create this academic environment around the LSD, right? Mm. Where he would have rooms in this mansion where people would just meditate for days and days and ingest substances.
Hmm.
So even within American culture, right, you have these very different uses of the same substances.
Right. And again, that challenges what we're talking about before, this overall idea of the national morality, national identity, right? Because there's tons of pockets anywhere of different ways of experiencing, using, thinking about the same object, same subject, same thing. You know, in this case, you know, LSD or acid or something, right? The same thing can be thought of many different ways. And so it does raise some interesting questions. I think that this is going to be fun to kind of tackle next week as we get more into the idea and maybe the drive of these kind of things. That some of the things that come to mind is actually, we can think about as like the drive of why we as people engage in these in the first place. And again, we're not the only species that does this.
No.
I mean, there's tons of examples. I mean, you can, you know, if you feel like typing animals and intoxication or animals and drunkenness or drug use on the internet, there's tons of things. I mean, there's examples of wallabies in Tasmania that will eat poppy flowers, particularly when their food supply gets low, they'll walk into poppy fields and eat them. And then they just, they videotape them just walking in circles.
Jaguars love to get high in the jungles of Central America.
Jaguars do it too, right? There's reindeer that do it in northern or eastern part of Europe. They seek out a certain kind of mushroom. And it's really interesting that the reindeer example is kind of fun to think about, because they're particularly, deers and sheep, they're pack or herd animals. They rarely go off by themselves. But when they're sort of in the mood for this mushroom, you'll see them going off by themselves. They'll be riskily going down cliff faces, or like these, they go, they, their behavior changes to find these things. The antisocial, right? Yeah, so it kind of changes. And actually, what other thing that I'm really excited that we can talk about is this notion, is a philosopher named Terence McKenna. He has this notion called the stoned ape theory. And it's this theory of sort of how and why humans evolved into ourselves and sort of where we came from. And he sort of posits, actually kind of like the Beerscape does, but in a different way, that is actually psychotrophics and mushrooms that, you know, the roving, if hunter-gatherers were just following, you know, yak herds or cow herds or something, they would, of course, be behind their droppings and lift them up looking for food, and they would find the mushrooms, and they would eat them. And so his theory, again, we can talk about the merits, the pluses and minuses of that, is sort of this is what opened the doors of hominid perception in through the notion of synesthesia, which is the mixing of senses. Like you may be able to hear colors or eat sounds. It sounds weird to say this, but check out synesthesia. It's interesting.
Yes.
But this is actually, he posits, helped us think of language, because if one being was grunting to another one, the other being would hear, see, or perceive something totally differently, and this helped develop an idea of thinking.
And communication.
Communication, right. Very fascinating theory.
Huh. Very fascinating. It's intriguing to me what you're saying, because it posits this question of what came first, a chicken and an egg scenario of yeah. beer or other types of intoxicants.
That's a great question too, yeah.
But with language as sort of coming to being after that, but what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, is that maybe music was there first.
It was one of the original things, yeah.
And music is something that can alter your state of being. And certain drum patterns that people use today in different tribal societies will give you that enhanced sort of psychotropic effect. They will bring you into these entranced moods.
That's a great idea, yes. I think definitely music is a great way to think about that too for next week. I'm also excited we'll be joined by a returning guest we've had before, Ben Jibo. He is a photographer. He did some work in China in November. Ryan and I had him on the show for an interview to talk about photography. Remember, we'll have him on next week also to talk about just the experience and the kind of the stoned ape theory and some ideas of psychotropia. And we're very excited to kind of see what will show up.
It'll be good.
Yeah. But I want to thank everybody for joining us. This is Adam Gamo for This Anthropological Life.
Yep. This is Anil Tripathi.
This is Ryan Collins. Thank you for altering our states.
Indeed. Hopefully your state is somewhat altered as well.
Got some new ideas out there.
Yeah. And we'll see you next week.
Have a good week, guys. Yeah.